Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 48, The Morning After. In studio with me today, Chef Chris Bradley of Untitled at the Whitney, and Rosemary Gray of RS Productions NYC, who's putting together the first ever Sherry Fest. I'm incredibly excited about that. We'll talk with her about how and why she has taken this on. Later in the show, our beloved What's on the Menu at Chardonnay's. Chardonnay's is our mythical restaurant that celebrates all bad food and wine trends. But first, our front of house segment with Jen Tulloch, our segment about front of house blunders.
Restaurant X was in its third year when it gave birth to its first offspring, a smaller spin-off restaurant which featured a similar menu. Restaurant XB, as we shall call it, was located literally a block from its original. I'm no genius, but something about this seemed off. Given the wild success of its mother, Restaurant XB was, like many first children, expected to be perfect in every way. Now, I'd been working as a server and bartender at the original location, and now found myself three nights a week at Little XB. Though the space was charming in concept and design, any fool could tell you that it was just too small for a large party. One tiny bathroom, low ceilings, and virtually no room to walk between tables made for a compact dining experience, and 10 little tables already felt crowded. Imagine, if you will, that scene in Willy Wonka just before they enter the chocolate room. Mike TV's mom would most definitely have a panic attack at XB, no question. 2 days after reopening the public, the owner, an infamous womanizer with a powder blue Vespa, announced that we would, contrary to all logic and good sense, be hosting a 50-person party for a famous fashion designer in our tiny dungeon. In those days, you see, I was dumb enough to protest such a thing. The cruel hands of restaurant brutality have since beaten me down into a slack-jawed mute, and so I voiced my concern. I was scorned just short of a public stoning and told to be grateful I would be meeting such a glamorous celebrity. Also, I can only assume this was punishment after my Norma Rae moment in the meeting. I was taken off the floor and demoted to running co-check for the event. Fabulous. Captain Vespa 1, Norma Rae 0. As the guests filed in that November night, it was my duty to collect their coats and run them downstairs to our makeshift coat rack that we'd thrown together in the moldy basement. The coats ran from wool cape to fur-length fur, and by the time I'd collected 5 or 6, I'd be weighed down like Atlas and wobble down the stairs into my dank little coat check lair. One of my fellow servers had been watching my struggles and followed me down the stairs. "Here," he said, "you look like you need a drink. I grabbed you this from the bar." He was holding a half glass of red wine, and I had never loved him more. "Oh, thank you so much," I said. "Let me just put these down and I'll take that from you." But I didn't take it from him, because as I turned to face the coat rack, I bumped him with my furry mound of coats, sending the half glass of Italian red all over the coats already hanging. We both froze. I dropped the pile I was holding to the floor and clamped my hand over my mouth. It was at this precise moment that the hostess of the party, Queen Sheba of the Fashion Desert herself, came trotting down the basement stairs holding an unlit cigarette.
"Hi, I need my coat. I'm going to smoke."
Sure, I said. What did it look like?
"It's a white fur," said the queen.
"Well, it's not white anymore." And I was right. I was never quite forgiven after the wine incident, and understandably so. I've always clung to the belief that my charms lie in the realm of personality over skill, and have little control over the disasters this seems to create. Restaurant XB closed a few months later due to poor sales, and I can't say I was sad. I can say, however, that to this day, I cover my glass of wine with my free hand until safely outdoors or in an area covered by tarps. For the morning after, I'm Jen Tulloch.
When we come back, we'll talk with Chef Chris Bradley of Untitled at the Whitney.
So.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. I'm in the studio with Chef Chris Bradley of Untitled at the Whitney. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I've had several people from the Danny Meyer world, and I know you were at Gramercy Tavern.
Yes.
Before you were at Untitled, but where were you before that? What got you to Gramercy and then to Untitled?
Sure. I've been in New York since about 2000. I started at Cafe Bleu with Andrew Carmelini, now Locanda Verde, mm-hmm. and every other restaurant in New York City that's opened up in the last year, it sounds like. A couple other restaurants, worked with Charlie Palmer at Oriole, here in Brooklyn with Saul, the Michelin-starred restaurant on Smith Street. And I think for Gramercy, I'd reached a point in my career where I was starting to get picky and wanted to go to what I called graduate school. So I looked at a couple of the finer restaurants, and really once I talked to Michael Anthony and all those guys, just realized they really had their act together. They were really into teaching and letting you grow. So, you know, that was an excellent opportunity for me, and spent 4 years there, eventually became the executive sous chef, ran the cheese program. And when Untitled came available, they talked to me, and it was it's not Godfather-esque, but it's hard to say no to Danny Meyer. So I was happy to be able to be given the chance to open something with those guys and learn that. It's amazing. They do it well and they do it smart.
And how was the transition from Gramercy, where it's a little bit more composed, to Untitled, which, I mean, you're trying to elevate the essentially the coffee shop or the museum cafe?
You know, that was the big selling point for me is when Danny and I were talking about it, you know, and I think I was going at this like, well, let's make a Gramercy Tavern type coffee shop. And he said, no. He said, make it a coffee shop, like a real coffee shop. But treat it with the same technique, with the same care, the same quality that you would if you were cooking the best piece of halibut or striped bass. You know, think about it in that perspective. Don't try and make it not what it is. Make it what it is and done really, really well. So that was just, for me, that was like, I get it now. I understand.
And you guys have a pretty serious focus on local farm-to-table, I mean, like farm-to-table coffee shop, what?
Yeah, you know what, that was, if you ask what the big transition was, it was going from Gramercy, where you've got every piece of equipment, you know, 40 people in the kitchen at any time, to what was originally a cafeteria kitchen in the old Whitney that we couldn't really, because of the structure, couldn't really change that much. We made a few adjustments, added a little bit of equipment, and learning what we could do well, mm-hmm. and what we couldn't do well. I think I came in having studied how to make our own sodas. We were going to, you know, make all our own desserts. And then I saw, well, I've got two ovens and it's going to be impossible to run a cafe all day long and do what we wanted. So I said, let's look at who does it best and let's get those guys in. And I live in Gowanus, and it just happened. There's a lot of great food artisans right where I live. We've got the 4 & 20 Blackbird Girls, mm-hmm. Blue Marble Ice Cream, Betty Bakery, who makes the best red velvet cake in the world, possibly. And so all those guys just sort of came together. We've picked up a few people who opened up over the last year, like Bien Cui. So it wasn't so much that I focused exclusively on Brooklyn, because we use Ore Washers.
Yeah, I was like, you're sourcing pastry from Brooklyn. It's kind of awesome.
Well, and then Brooklyn Brine Pickles are literally two blocks from my house. So all those guys just sort of came together. But we use Ore Washers, who makes classic ryes and challahs. Again, found them to be the best in the city over so many tastings. Mm-hmm. I think one day I ate probably 15 different pints of ice cream until I was almost
sick. Oh, poor you.
Yeah, I know. So, you know, it wasn't just Brooklyn, but it just so happens that right now that's where the food artisans are. And so I was happy to bring Brooklyn to the Upper East Side.
And like I said earlier, we've had several front of house people from Gramercy Tavern.
Yes.
And other Danny Meyer restaurants. And so I know that hospitality is the main philosophy of Danny Meyer's business model. How do you approach that in the kitchen? Because I can completely understand how they approach it in the front of house. How do you approach that in the kitchen?
It's really the same attitude. It's it's working well with the people you see every day, taking care of them before everything. So, you know, I don't want to say it's a little cliched to think that there's always a front of the house and back of the house divide, that, you know, back of the house feels like, oh, they're screwing up and it's making my life hard and they're making so much money. Not everybody has that attitude. It is present. You set a culture where you don't have that. You know, you realize what's good for you is good for them. You bail them out one time because they forgot to ring in an order. They grab you a cup of coffee in the morning, you know, mm-hmm. bring it around and say, hey, here's a cup of coffee for everybody. It's just that sort of idea that it infects everything you do, from when you put your whites on in the morning until you kick them off in the evening all sweaty and dirty and leave for the next day. So
the watching out for each other.
Yeah, yeah. That's the biggest thing, you know. And it's, again, I've worked for some chefs who borderline physically assaulted people. None of that, you know. It's, you can still motivate people without the fear and the anger, and learning that takes a little time because it's what you've seen for most of your career, and then you learn. I mean, I'm a bit of a smartass, can I say that? So I'm a little more, you know, I give you a joke and a little, like a biting little joke, and you get it. Oh yeah, yeah, I should be trying to do better, and that's all we really want, is everybody to give 100%. And we know you're going to fail. We don't believe in perfection. We believe in quality. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, everybody's going to make mistakes, and we're there to catch you, to pick you up. I think that's where hospitality works, in the back of the house.
And as far as having a restaurant within a museum, I can imagine that they're, you know, I can't even imagine what the clientele is like. It's tourists.
It's a good mix. Yeah. And, you know, and we'll see it. We've got a good local clientele. So when there's great things in the museum, when they've got a brand new exhibit, you know, we'll get crushed with tourists and people from other parts. But, you know, our locals know, let's take this weekend off. Let's wait till the event dies down. They come back 2 weeks and we see our regulars. Weekends, Saturday, Sunday brunch, it's 90% people from the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. We've got our regulars. We love them. They love us. And so we've got a good mix of people coming in. It's just great to know we're going to have all that foot traffic from people coming to see a museum.
And I also read online, you guys kind of do like a little picnic.
Yep. Yeah. We're 2 blocks from Central Park. So for the summer, we had some
for the summer. That makes sense.
Yeah. We had some canvas bags made, with our untitled sign on them. And then we had options of sandwiches, salads. We're running it through October, just cause it's still been slightly warm enough to do picnics. And then October, we figure it's going to be too cold after that, and we'll shut it down until next spring.
And so I know you're always cooking in the museum, but do you ever get to walk around?
It's kind of amazing. I mean, as technically an employee of the Whitney, I can see every museum in the city and possibly several others around the country for free. So yeah, every time a new exhibit comes, I'll just, you know, even if it's just, I'll take a 30-minute break from the restaurant, run through, see a few things. And, you know, I have that right in my backyard, basically. It's easy to do. It's fun. It's incredible to get that sort of opportunity.
And the Whitney is a Museum of American Art,
and right.
So and Untitled has absolutely taken influence.
You know, that's where when we did the idea, that was sort of the symbiotic relationship we saw, was that we're going to be something classic American, just as they are focused strictly on sort of American artisans.
Do you have any new dishes or anything coming up?
You know, we've on the menu? We've been doing crepes for the summer. They were with fresh berries. We're probably going to switch to most likely some pumpkin, or we may find some sort of nice fall squash that we can season up and treat like pumpkin to stuff them with. What are we moving into again? You know, again, our omelet fillings sort of change seasonally.
Seasonal omelet.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll move away from some of the squashes and things we're doing now into some of the heartier fall root vegetables and things like that.
And so where is the Whitney located, just if anybody wants to go get some fall omelet?
It's on Madison Avenue between 74th and 75th.
Thank you so much, Chris.
My pleasure.
You heard the address. Check out Untitled at the Whitney. When we come back, we'll be talking to Rosemary Gray, taking on Sherry Fest. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. I'm in studio here with Rosemary Gray. Rosemary, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
She is the founder, creator of RS Productions NYC.
That's correct.
And she has created a week-long Sherry Madness event called Sherry Fest. Why and how? I mean, how did you get involved in this?
Well, RS Productions is a boutique consulting company that I started in the spring, essentially to coordinate and facilitate educational events for the wine industry. Most of them are on a much smaller scale than Sherry Fest. So having that infrastructure, I've worked a lot with Peter Liam, who's my partner for Sherry Fest, the well-known wine writer who is most known for writing about champagne, mm-hmm. but is coming out with a book on Sherry this month. So when he, you know, he and I have worked on several projects together, and he approached me last winter and, you know, told me about the Sherry Fest book and when he was planning to publish it. And at the time asked me if I would be interested in coordinating a, you know, a big tasting event with him at the same time of the book release. And he thought, you know, we can get some bodegas to come over from Spain and we'll do, you know, we'll do an industry style tasting. Nobody's done this before in the United States. And I said, yes. I mean, why is because sherry is delicious. Mm-hmm. And it's at this very interesting point, I think, in the New York market where people are really interested in it. But there's also some gaps in knowledge and understanding about sherry. It's something that's been had been marginalized for a long time or suffered from having sort of mass industrial products that were the predominant examples. So I think that people haven't had a lot of exposure to fine sherry and haven't had a chance to learn about it. And so really the goal was to try to bring bodegas over here so that the New York market could begin to, you know, so that sommeliers and writers and people in retail could meet people, from the bodegas and just gain a better understanding of sherry.
And are you going to be, as far as the bodegas that have gotten involved, are there some that are a much smaller production? Because, you know, I think in the market we see Gonzalez Baez, Lustau kind of being huge here. Mm-hmm. Are there any kind of smaller bodegas that...
It's a mix of both, you know. Mm-hmm. We definitely, you know, definitely the bigger bodegas are here, but yeah, you know, we have.
I'm glad they are. Just wanted to know.
There's about 15 coming. There's over 20 that are participating in Sherry Fest overall, so it's a long list. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of people coming from Spain, so all that, you know, it's a lot of the producers that you've seen, but maybe. Yeah, maybe some of the smaller ones as well. So,
What kind of events have you organized so far?
So Sherry Fest actually it snowballed. You know, we started with this tasting idea, which was the centerpiece was to create an industry style tasting. And so that's happening on Monday, October 22nd. And so that's. You know, that is your standard industry walk-around tasting where the bodegas will be able to pour their wines for, you know, for people in the industry and everybody can kind of come and taste. So that's a centerpiece event. But then around that, since we had so many people traveling from Spain, we really wanted to create opportunities for consumers and for other people to engage with the producers more, more directly and more deeply. And so we've created... 8 dinner events that will be happening Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So Monday the 22nd and then through Wednesday the 24th. So at each dinner event, there are at least 2 producer hosts. One of the dinner event has 4 producers. And they're partnering restaurants around the city. And so those are all small dinners. They're 20 to 30 seats and really allow people to come to dinner and engage with the wines, with food, and be able to talk and dialogue with the producers and the people that are visiting here from Spain. So those, to me, are really the heart of Sherry Fest, is being able to see sherry at its best with food, mm-hmm. and being able to, you know, to meet the people that are making these wines.
And what other sommeliers have you gotten involved, or restaurant owners? Where, like, what locations
they,
are?
So the Monday night dinners will be at the Bar Jamon space with Casa Mono Food. So Ashley Santoro, the wine director there, is helping us with that event. Also on Monday night, there will be a slam and jamon party at Pata Negra that will be a very rambunctious Spanish-style party. That'll be with Emilio Hidalgo and Barbadillo. And then that night, there's also a dinner event at the Beagle, so the cocktail lounge in the East Village that has been one of the foremost sherry advocates in the cocktail scene.
I remember going there for the first time, and I was like, "There are 12 sherries by the glass.
Yeah,
this is fantastic." Yeah, and it's not a Spanish focused menu at all,
right? And so that dinner and a couple other dinners are going to be really great opportunities to see how sherry pairs with food that we might think of as an unconventional pairing with mm-hmm. sherry. And in that sense, we really hope to have people understand that there's the diversity of sherry and the compatibility and versatility at the table.
And you're also going to have some, while these dinners are going to be educational, you also have some seminars that
yes,
you guys are
yes.
running as well, right?
Yeah, so there's more, there's other dinner events. There's a dinner event at Palo Cortado on mm-hmm. Tuesday, at Tia Pol on Tuesday, at El Quinto Pino on Tuesday. And then Wednesday we have Hearth, and then La Piccio, which will, highly anticipated new restaurant opening, will be one of the first events at La Piccio. And then in the day, there's seminar events. So there's seminar events at Terroir Tribeca on Tuesday and Wednesday morning. There is a seminar event at Cork Buzz on Tuesday afternoon, and a seminar event at Crush in the evening. Most of the seminar events are now sold out. Mm-hmm. There's the Grand Tasting event on Monday is completely booked.
Congratulations.
There are hundreds of people that are coming. We have people traveling from Portland and California and Canada and all along the East Coast are coming up to participate in Sherry Fest. So, but there's plenty of dinner seats open, and we really hope to kind of engage consumers and people that are curious about sherry but haven't yet dove in. Like, if you're not a sherry aficionado, don't be afraid. These are going to be really, really just fun dinners to engage with, with the producers, and to take any level of interest or awareness you have of sherry to the next level.
And for these dinners, I think it would be just really amazing to be able to see kind of the gamut of what sherry can do and the variations. Yeah. Because, not knowing enough about sherry, I'd be like, well, how many different styles are there? Or how many,
so many
yeah,
different
and
styles.
And how can you pair that with food? Like, will it really do that much for food? And I think it will.
Yeah, that's the big awakening, is that I think that people have a really narrow concept of what they think sherry is. But the truth is that there are so many different styles of wine that are considered sherry. And most of the dinners will feature 8 or more different kinds of wine, some even Brandy de Jerez. So there's an amazing diversity there. And then on the Saturday before, on the 20th, I don't want to forget to mention all the retailers that are working with us. We have over 30 stores in citywide will be pouring sherry in store on October 20th. So you can check out your local retailer, but we will be city poured. There will be sherry poured all over the city that Saturday.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
So let us know where people can find events. And
everything is on the website. Everything is on sherryfest.com. So if you want reservation for dinners or for seminars or to find out about in-store tastings, everything is on sherryfest.com. And you can go there and find out all of the details and book a reservation and... Yeah.
Well,
drink sherry.
I wish you tons of luck, and I certainly will be attending an event or two. When we come back, we're going to ask Chris about what's on the menu at Chardonnay's the morning after.
You are listening to AM by Shadowbox on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
When I'm with you.
The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. One of my favorite segments that we've been doing for the last about five episodes or four episodes is what's on the menu at Chardonnay's. Chardonnay's is the mythical restaurant that celebrates all bad food and wine trends. I hope to have an entire Chardonnay's menu one day, an entire wine list, maybe even a playlist, the design scheme and everything. So Chris Bradley, chef at Untitled at the Whitney, what is on the menu at Chardonnay's?
You know, today it's a classic. I actually remember having to make this special for a celebrity who may or may not have sponsored Jell-O brand pudding. Stop!
I have no idea who you're talking about.
But he used to come into Cafe Blue and request this, and this was 2000, so even then it was sort of dated. So this is spinach salad. Blue cheese, walnuts, and the kicker is the raspberry dressing. Yeah, super sweet, super tangy. So the flavor compounds all hit together, but I just remember that super sweet raspberry reduction dressing, raspberry vinaigrette with blue cheese that he just insisted upon having every time he came in, and I sort of knew, you know, we got to make this. So it's very dated. I wouldn't say it's not delicious. I'd just say I'd rather not go that sweet on my salads.
That absolutely sounds like a salad on the menu at Chardonnay's. I mean, I guess I'll throw this to you too, Rosemary. I know you've been in the wine world for a long time. So what sherry is on the menu at Chardonnay's?
Oh, gosh, that's... I think that you'd probably, you know, have to serve some Harvey's Bristol Cream.
Yes.
I think that's yeah.
Exactly. And I could use it in a sauce for a veal chop with some mushrooms as well.
Fantastic. Adding items to the menu at Chardonnay's. Thanks for joining me, guys. It's been a great episode.
Thank you.
If anybody out there likes what they're hearing, there's a lot of other great shows on this network. You can go onto heritageradionetwork.org and check it out. Also, to keep us around, donate. You know, if you like what you're hearing, become a member. Morning After, heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Jesse Kiefer. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.